Wallfacer Luoji, I have a question for you. Given that this is a spell, why don't you direct it at the enemy's world? Luoji said, This is a proof of concept. Its actual implementation will wait for the Doomsday Battle. Can't Trisolaris be used as the test target? Luoji shook his head with finality. Absolutely not. It's too close. It's close enough that the effects of the spell might reach us. That's why I rejected any planetary star system within 50 light years. One final question. Over the next 100 or more years, what do you plan on doing? You'll be free of me. Hibernation. Wake me when the effects of the spell on 187J3X1 are detected. As he was preparing for hibernation, Luoji came down with the bed flu. His initial symptoms were no different from everyone else, just a runny nose and a slight throat inflammation, and neither he nor anyone else paid it any attention. But 2 days later, his condition worsened, and he began to run a fever. The doctor found this abnormal and took a blood sample back to the city for analysis. Luoji spent the night in a fevered torpor, haunted endlessly by restless dreams in which the stars in the night sky swirled and danced like grains of sand on the skin of a drum. He was even aware of the gravitational interaction between these stars. It wasn't three-body motion, but the 200 billion body motion of all the stars in the galaxy. Then the swirling stars clustered into an enormous vortex, and in that mad spiral, the vortex transformed again into a giant serpent, formed from the congealed silver of every star, which drilled into his brain with a roar. At around 4 in the morning, Zhang Xiang was awakened by his phone. It was a call from the Planetary Defense Council Security Department leadership, who, in severe tones, demanded that he report immediately on Luoji's condition and ordered the base to be put under a state of emergency. A team of experts was on its way over. As soon as he hung up the phone, it rang again, this time with a call from the doctor in the 10th basement, who reported that the patient's condition had sharply deteriorated and he was now in a state of shock. Zhang Xiang descended the elevator at once, and the panicked doctor and nurse informed him that Luoji had begun spitting up blood in the middle of the night and then had gone unconscious. Zhang Xiang saw Luoji lying on the bed with a pale face, purple lips, and practically no signs of life in his body. The team, consisting of experts from the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention, doctors from the General Hospital of the PLA, and an entire research team from the Academy of Military Medical Sciences soon arrived. As they observed Luoji's condition, one expert from the AMMS took Jiang Xiang and Kent outside and described the situation to them.
This flu came to our attention a while ago. We felt that its origin and characteristics were highly abnormal, and it's clear now that it's a genetic weapon, a genetic-guided missile.
A guided missile?
It's a genetically altered virus that is highly infectious, but only causes mild flu symptoms in most people. However, the virus has a recognition ability which allows it to identify the genetic characteristics of a particular individual. Once the target has been infected, it creates deadly toxins in his blood. We now know who the target is.
Zhang Xiang and Kent glanced at each other, first in incredulity and then in despair. Zhang Xiang blanched and bowed his head.
I accept full responsibility.
The researcher, a senior colonel, said,
Director Zhang, you can't say that. There's no defense against this. Although we had begun to suspect something odd about the virus, we never even considered this possibility. The concept of genetic weapons first appeared in the last century, but no one believed that anyone would actually produce one. And although this one's imperfect,
It truly is a frightening tool for assassination. All you need to do is spread the virus in the target's general vicinity. Or rather, you don't even need to know where the target is. You could just spread it across the globe, and because the virus causes little to no illness in ordinary people, it will spread quickly and would probably strike its target in the end.
No, I accept full responsibility, Zheng said, covering his eyes. If Captain Sher was here, this wouldn't have happened. He dropped his hand and his eyes shone with tears. The last thing he said to me before hibernation was to warn me of what you said about no defence. He said, Xiao Zheng, in this job of ours we need to sleep with one eye open. There's no certainty of success, and some things we can't defend against.
So what do we do next? Kent asked.
The virus has penetrated deep. The patient's liver and cardiopulmonary functions have failed, and modern medicine is helpless. Hibernate him as soon as possible.
After a long while, when Luo Ji recovered a little of the consciousness that had totally disappeared, he had sensations of cold, a cold that seemed to emanate from within his body and diffuse outward like light to freeze the entire world. He saw a snow-white patch in which there first was nothing but infinite white. Then a small black dot appeared at its very centre, and he could gradually make out a familiar figure, Zhuang Yan, holding their child. He walked with difficulty through a snowy wilderness so empty that it lost all dimension. She was wrapped in a red scarf, the same one she had worn 7 years ago on the snowy night he first saw her. The child, red-faced from the cold, waved two small hands at him from her mother's embrace and shouted something that he couldn't hear. He wanted to chase them through the snow, but the young mother and child vanished, as if dissolved into the snow. Then he himself vanished, and the snowy white world shrank into a thin silver thread, which in the unbounded darkness was all that remained of his consciousness. It was the thread of time, a thin, motionless strand that extended infinitely in both directions. His soul, strung on this thread, was gently sliding off at a constant speed into the unknowable future. 2 days later, a stream of high-power radio waves was sent off from Earth toward the sun, penetrating the convection zone and reaching the energy mirror in the radiation zone, where its reflection, magnified hundreds of millions of times, carried wall-facer Luo Ji's spell into the cosmos at the speed of light.
Year 12, Crisis Era. Distance of the Trisolaran fleet from the solar system, 4.18 light-years. Another brush had appeared in space. The Trisolaran fleet had crossed the second patch of interstellar dust, and because Hubble 2 had been closely monitoring the area, the fleet's wake was captured as soon as it appeared. This time, it looked nothing like a brush. Rather, it resembled a patch of grass that had just begun to sprout in the dark abyss of space. Those thousand blades of grass grew with a speed that was perceptible to the naked eye, and they were much clearer than the wake had been 9 years before, due to 9 years of acceleration that had greatly increased the fleet's speed and had made its impact on the interstellar dust more dramatic.
General, look closely here. What can you see?
Rongier said to Fitzroy as he pointed to the magnified image on the screen.
There still seems to be about 1,000.
No, look closer.
Fitzroy looked carefully for a moment, then pointed to the middle of the brush.
It looks like 10 bristles are longer than the others. They're extended out.
Right. Those 10 wakes are quite weak. They're only visible after image enhancement.
Fitzroy turned to Rongier, wearing the same expression he had when the Trisolaran fleet had been discovered a decade earlier.
Doctor, does this mean that those 10 warships are accelerating?
All of them are accelerating, but those 10 show a greater acceleration. But they're not 10 warships. The number of wakes has increased by 10 to 1,010. An analysis of the morphology of those 10 wakes shows that they are far smaller than the warships behind them, about 1/10,000th the size, or about the size of a truck. But due to their high speed, they still produce detectable wakes.
So small. Are they probes?
Yes, they must be probes.
This was another of Hubble II's shocking discoveries. Humanity would make contact with Trisolaran entities ahead of schedule, even if they were just 10 small probes.
When will they reach the solar system?
Fitzroy asked nervously.
We can't say for certain. It depends on the acceleration, but they will definitely arrive before the fleet. A conservative estimate would be half a century earlier. The fleet acceleration is evidently at a maximum, but for some reason we don't understand, they want to reach the solar system as quickly as possible, so they launched the probes that can accelerate even faster.
If they have sophons, then what's the need for probes?
One engineer asked. This question made them all stop and think. But Rongier soon broke the silence.
Forget it, this isn't something we can figure out.
No, Fitzroy said, raising a hand. We can figure out at least a part of it. We're looking at events from 4 years ago. Can you determine the exact date that the fleet launched the probes?
We're fortunate that the fleet launched them on the snow, I mean in the dust, allowing us to pinpoint the time from our observations of the intersection of the probe wakes and the fleet tracks.
Then Rongier told him the date. Fitzroy was speechless for a moment, then lit a cigarette and sat down to smoke. After a while he said,
Doctor, you're not politicians. Just like I couldn't make out those 10 longer bristles, you can't tell that this is a crucial fact.
What's so special about that date?
Rongier asked uncertainly.
On that day, 4 years ago, I attended the PDC wall-facer hearing at which Luo Ji proposed using the sun to send a spell out into the universe.
The scientists and engineers glanced at each other.
Fitzroy went on. And it was right around that time that Trisolaris issued a second command to the ETO calling for Luo Ji's elimination.
Is he really that important?
You think he was first a sentimental playboy and then a pretentious sham sorcerer, of course. We thought so too. Everyone did. Except for Trisolaris.
Well, what do you think he is, General?
Doctor, do you believe in God?
The suddenness of the question left Rongier momentarily speechless.
God? That's got a variety of meanings on multiple levels today, and I don't know which you...
I believe, not because I have any proof, but because it's relatively safe. If there really is a God, then it's right to believe in him. If there isn't, then we don't have anything to lose.
The general's words prompted laughter, and Rongier said,
The second half is untrue. There is something to lose, at least as far as science is concerned. Still, so what if God exists? What's he got to do with what's right in front of us?
If God really exists, then he may have a mouthpiece in the mortal world.
They all stared at him for ages before they understood the implication of his words. Then one astronomer said,
General, what are you talking about?
God wouldn't choose a mouthpiece from an atheist nation.
Fitzroy ground out his cigarette end and spread out his hands.
When you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. Can you think of a better explanation?
Rongier mused. If by God you mean a force of justice in the universe that transcends everything... Fitzroy stopped him with a raised hand, as if the divine power of what they had just learned would be reduced if it were stated outright.
So believe, all of you. You can now start believing.
And then he made the sign of the cross. The trial run of TNT-3 was airing on television. Construction on 3 space elevators had begun 5 years ago, and since TNT-1 and TNT-2 had been put into operation at the start of the year, the test of TNT-3 did not cause much of a commotion. All space elevators were currently being built with just a single preliminary rail, giving them a far smaller carrying capacity than the 4 rail models still under design, but this was already an altogether different world from the age of chemical rockets. Setting aside construction, the cost of going into space by elevator was substantially lower than by civilian aircraft. This, in turn, had led to an increase in the number of bodies in motion in Earth's night sky. These were humanity's large-scale orbiting structures. TNT-3 was the only space elevator based on the ocean. Its base was located on the equator, on an artificial floating island in the Pacific Ocean, that could navigate at sea under its own nuclear power, which meant that the elevator's position on the equator could be adjusted if necessary. The floating island was a real-life version of the propeller island Jules Verne had described, and so it had been dubbed Verne Island. The ocean wasn't even visible on the television, which was showing a shot of a metal pyramid-shaped base surrounded by a steel city, and at the bottom of the rail, the cylindrical transport cabin that was ready to launch. From this distance, the guide rail extending into space was invisible due to its 60-centimetre diameter, although at times you could catch a glint of reflected light from the setting sun. 3 old men, Zhang Yuan Chao and his 2 old neighbours, Yang Jin Wen and Miao Fu Chuan, were watching this on television. All of them were now past 70, and while no one would call them doddering, they were now definitely old. For them, recalling the past and looking toward the future were both burdens, and since they were powerless to do anything about the present, their only option was to live out their waning years without thinking about anything in this unusual era. Zhang Yuan Chao's son, Zhang Wei Ming, led his grandson, Zhang Yan, through the door. He was carrying a paper sack and said, "Dad, I've picked up your ration card and your first batch of grain tickets." Then he took out a pack of colourful tickets from the bag and gave them to his father.
"Ah, just like in the old days," Yang Jin Wen said as he watched from the side. "It's come back. It always comes back," Zhang Yuan Chao murmured emotionally to himself as he took the tickets.
"Is that money?" asked Yan Yan, looking at the bits of paper.
Zhang Yuan Chao said to his grandson,
"It's not money, child. But from now on, if you want to buy non-quota grain, like bread or cake, or want to eat at a restaurant, you'll need to use these along with money."
"This is a little different from the old days," Zhang Wei Ming said, taking out an IC card. "This is a ration card."
"How much is on it?"
"I get 21.5 kilos, or 43 jin. You and Xiao Hong get 37 jin, and Yan Yan gets 21 jin."
"About the same as back then," the elder man said.
That should be enough for a month, Yang Jinwen said. Zhang Wei Ming shook his head.
Mr. Yang, you lived through those days, don't you remember? It might be fine now, but very soon there'll be fewer non-staples, and you'll need numbers to buy vegetables and meat. So this paltry bit of grain really won't be enough to eat.
It's not that serious, Miao Fuchuan said with a wave of his hand. We've been through times like these a few decades ago. We won't starve. Drop it and watch TV.
Oh, and industrial coupons may be coming soon, too, Zhang Yuan Chao said, putting the grain tickets and ration card on the table and turning his attention to the television. On the screen, the cylindrical cabin was rising from the base. It ascended quickly and accelerated rapidly, then disappeared into the evening sky. Because the guide rail was invisible, it looked like it was ascending on its own. The cabin could reach a maximum speed of 500 kilometers per hour, but even at that speed it would take 68 hours to reach the space elevator's terminus in geostationary orbit. The scene cut to a downward-facing camera installed beneath the cabin. Here, the 60-centimeter rail occupied the larger part of the screen. Its slick surface made motion practically undetectable, except for the fleeting scale markings that showed the camera's upward velocity. The rail quickly tapered into nothing as it extended downward, but it pointed at a spot far below where Verne Island, now visible in total, seemed like a giant platter suspended from the lower end of the rail. Something occurred to Yang Jinwen.
I'll show you two a real rarity, he said as he got up and walked somewhat less nimbly out the door, perhaps to his own home. He soon returned with a thin slice of something about the size of a cigarette box and laid it on the table. Zhang Yuan Chao picked it up and looked at it. The object was grey, translucent, and very lightweight, like a fingernail.
This is the material TNT is made out of, Yang Jinwen said. Great. Your son stole strategic materials from the public sector, Miao Fuchuan said, pointing at the slice. It's just a leftover scrap. He said that when TNT was under construction, thousands upon thousands of tons of this stuff was shot into space, and it was made into the guide rail there and then hung back down from orbit again. Soon, space travel will be popularized. I've asked my son to hook me up with business in that area.
You want to go into space? Asked Zhang Yuan Chao, surprised.
It's not such a big deal. I've heard there's not even hypergravity when you go up. It's just like taking a long-distance sleeper train, Miao Fuchuan said dismissively. In the many years he had been unable to operate his mines, his family had gone into decline. They had sold off his villa 4 years ago, leaving this as his only residence. Yang Jinwen, whose son worked on the space elevator project, had in a single bound become the wealthiest of the three, and this sometimes made old Miao jealous.
I'm not going into space, Yang Jinwen said, looking up, and when he saw that Wei Ming had taken the boy to another room, he went on, But my remains will. Hey, you two fellows don't have any taboos about talking about this, do you?
What's taboo about it? Still, why do you want to put your remains up there?
Zhang Yuan Chao asked. You know there's an electromagnetic launcher at the end of TNT. When it's time, my casket will be fired off at the third cosmic velocity and will fly out of the solar system. It's called a cosmic burial, you know. After I die, I don't want to stay on an alien-occupied Earth. It's a form of escapism, I guess.
And if the aliens are defeated?
That's practically impossible.
Still, if it really happens, it's no great loss. I get to roam the universe.
Zheng Yuan Chao shook his head.
You intellectuals with your weird ideas, they're pointless. The fallen leaf returns to the root. I'm going to be buried in the yellow soil of the earth.
Aren't you afraid that the Trisolarans will dig up your grave?
At this, Miao Fu Chuan, who had been silent, suddenly grew excited. He motioned for the others to draw closer and lowered his voice, as if afraid that the Sofons would hear.
Don't tell anyone, but I've thought of something. I have lots of empty mines in Shanxi.
You want to be buried there?
No, no, they're all small pit mines. How deep can they be? But in several places they're connected to major state-owned mines, and by following their abandoned works, you can get all the way down to 400 meters below ground. Is that deep enough for you? Then we blast the shaft wall. I don't think the Trisolarans will be able to dig down there.
Sheesh, if Earthlings can dig that far, why can't the Trisolarans? They'll find a tombstone and just keep digging down.
Looking at Zheng Yuan Chao, Miao Fu Chuan was unable to hold back his laughter.
Oh, Zheng, have you gone stupid?
Seeing him still at a loss, he pointed to young Jin Wen, who had grown bored with their conversation and was watching the television broadcast again.
Let an educated man tell it to you.
Young Jin Wen chuckled.
Lao Zheng, what do you want a tombstone for? Tombstones are meant for people to see. By then, there won't be any people left.
All along the way to the third nuclear fusion test base, Zheng Beihai's car drove through deep snow. But as he neared the base, the snow melted entirely. The road turned muddy, and the cold air turned warm and humid, like a breath of springtime. On the slopes lining the road, he noticed patches of peach flowers blooming, unseasonable in this harsh winter. He drove on toward the white building in the valley ahead, a structure that was merely the entrance for the majority of the base, which was underground. Then he noticed someone on the hillside picking peach flowers. Looking closer, he saw it was the very person he had come to see, and he stopped the car.
Dr. Ding!
He called to him. When Ding Yi came over to the car carrying a bunch of flowers, he laughed and asked, Who are those flowers for?
They're for myself, of course. They're flowers that have bloomed from fusion heat.
He practically beamed under the influence of the brightly coloured flowers. Evidently he was still in the throes of excitement at the breakthrough that had just been achieved.
It's pretty wasteful letting all this heat disperse.
Zheng Beihai got out of the car, took off his sunglasses, and took stock of the mini spring. He couldn't see his breath, and he could feel the heat of the ground even through the soles of his shoes.
There's no money or time to build a power plant. But that doesn't matter. From now on, energy is not something that Earth needs to conserve.
Zheng Beihai pointed at the flowers in Ding Yi's hands.
Dr. Ding, I really was hoping that you had gotten distracted. This breakthrough would have happened later without you.
Without me here, it would have happened even earlier.
There are over 1,000 researchers at the base. I just pointed them in the right direction. I felt for a long time that the tokamak approach is a dead end. Given the right approach, a breakthrough was a certainty. Me, I'm a theoretician. I don't get experimentation. My blind pointing probably only delayed the progress of research.
Can't you postpone the announcement of your results? I'm being serious here, and I'm also informally conveying the wish of Space Command.
How could we postpone it? The media has been actively tracking the progress of all three fusion test bases.
Zheng Beihai nodded and let out a sigh. That's bad news.
I know a few of the reasons, but why don't you tell me why?
If controlled nuclear fusion is achieved, spacecraft research will begin immediately. Doctor, you know about the two current research forks, media-propelled spacecraft and non-media radiation drive spacecraft. Two opposing factions have formed around these two directions of research. The aerospace faction advocates research into media-propelled spacecraft, while the Space Force is pushing radiation-drive spacecraft. The projects will consume enormous resources, and if the two directions can't progress simultaneously on equal footing, then one direction must take the mainstream.
The fusion people and I are in favour of the radiation drive. For my part, I feel that it's the only plan that enables interstellar cosmic voyages. Of course, I'll grant the aerospace has its logic, too. Media-propelled spacecraft are actually a variant of chemical rockets that use fusion energy, so the prospects are a little safer for that line of research.
But there's nothing safe in the space war of the future. As you said, media-propelled spacecraft are just huge rockets. They have to devote two-thirds of their carrying capacity to their propulsion media, and it's consumed very quickly. That type of spacecraft requires planetary bases in order to navigate through the solar system. We do that, and we would be reenacting the tragedy of the Sino-Japanese War with the solar system as Wei Highway.
That's a keen analogy, Ding Yi said, raising his bouquet at Zheng Beihai.
It's a fact. A navy's frontline defences ought to be at the enemy's ports. We can't do that, of course, but our defensive line ought to be pushed out as far as the Oort cloud, and we should ensure that the fleet possesses sufficient flanking capabilities in the vast reaches outside the solar system. This is the foundation of Space Force strategy.
Internally, aerospace isn't entirely monolithic, Ding Yi said. It's the old guard left over from the chemical rocket era that's pushing for media spacecraft, but forces from other disciplines have entered the sector. Take the people on our fusion system. They're mostly pushing for radiation spacecraft. These two forces are evenly matched, and all that's needed is three or four people in key positions to break the equilibrium. Their opinions will decide the ultimate course of action. But those three or four key people are, I'm afraid, all part of the old guard.
This is the most critical decision in the entire master strategy. If it's a misstep, the space fleet will be built atop a mistaken foundation, and we might waste a century or two, and by that time I'm afraid there will be no way to change direction.
But you and I aren't in a position to fix it.
After lunching with Ding Yi, Zheng Beihai left the fusion base. Before he had driven very far, the moist ground was again covered with wet snow that glowed white under the sun. As the air temperature plummeted, his heart also chilled. He was in dire need of a spacecraft capable of interstellar travel. If other roads led nowhere, then just one was left. No matter how dangerous it might be, it had to be taken. When Zheng Beihai entered the home of the meteorite collector, situated in a courtyard house in the depths of a Hutong alleyway, he noticed that the old, dimly lit home was like a miniature geological museum. Each of its four walls was lined with glass cases, in which professional lights shone on rock after unremarkable rock. The owner, in his 50s, hale in spirit and complexion, sat at a workbench examining a small stone with a magnifying lens, and he greeted the visitor warmly when he saw him. He was, Zheng Beihai noticed immediately, one of those fortunate people who inhabited a beloved world of his own. No matter what changes befell the larger world, he could always immerse himself in his own and find contentment. In the old-fashioned atmosphere unique to old houses, Zheng Beihai was reminded that he and his comrades were fighting for the survival of the human race, while the majority of people were still clinging to their existing lives. This gave him a sense of warmth and peace of mind. The completion of the space elevator and the breakthrough in controlled fusion technology were two enormous encouragements to the world and eased defeatist sentiment to a considerable extent. But sober leaders were aware that this was only the beginning. If the construction of the space fleet was analogous to naval fleets, then humanity had just now arrived at the seashore carrying tools. Not even the shipbuilding dockyards had been built yet. Apart from the construction of the main spacecraft body, research into space weapons and recirculating ecosystems, as well as the construction of spaceports, represented an unprecedented technological frontier for humanity. Just getting the foundations in place might take a century. Human society faced another challenge aside from the terrifying abyss. The construction of a space defense system would consume an enormous amount of resources, and this consumption would likely drag the quality of life back a century, which meant that the greatest challenge to the human spirit was still to come. With that in mind, the military leadership had decided to begin implementing the plan to use political cadres from the Space Force as future reinforcements. As the initial proponent of the plan, Zheng Beihai had been named commander of the Special Contingent of Future Reinforcements. Upon accepting the mission, he proposed that all of the officers in the Special Contingent ought to undergo at least a year of space-based training and work before entering hibernation, in order to provide them with the necessary preparations for their future work in the Space Force. "The brass won't want their political commissars to be landlubbers," he said to Zheng Wei Sir. This request was swiftly approved, and 1 month later, he and the first special contingent of 30 comrades went to space.
"You're a soldier?" the collector asked as he served tea. After receiving a nod, he went on, "Soldiers these days aren't much like soldiers used to be, but you... I could tell at a glance."
"You were a soldier once too?" Zheng Beihai said.
"Good eye. I spent most of my life serving in the General Staff Department's Surveying and Mapping Bureau."
"How did you get interested in meteors?" Zheng Beihai asked as he looked appreciatively at the rich collection.
"Over a decade ago, I went with a survey team to Antarctica in search of meteorites buried beneath the snow, and I got hooked. They come from outside of Earth, from distant space, so naturally they've got that attraction. Whenever I pick one up, it's like I'm going to a new and alien world."
Zheng Beihai shook his head with a smile.
"That's just a feeling. The Earth itself is formed out of aggregated interstellar matter, so it's basically just like a giant meteorite. The stone beneath our feet is meteorite. This teacup I'm holding is meteorite. Besides, they say that the water on Earth was brought here by comets, so..." He raised the teacup. "What's contained in this cup is meteorite too. There's nothing particularly special about what you have."
The collector pointed at him and laughed.
"You're sharp. You've already started to bargain. Still, I trust my feelings."
The collector couldn't resist taking Zheng Beihai on a tour, and he even opened a safe to show him the treasure of his house. A Martian achondrite the size of a fingernail. He had him view the small round pits on the meteorite's surface and said that they might be microbial fossils.
5 years ago, Robert Haag wanted to buy her for 1,000 times the price of gold, but I didn't agree."
"How many of these did you collect on your own?" asked Zheng Beihai, pointing around the room.
"Only a small part. The majority were bought from the private sector or traded from the community. So let's hear it. What sort do you want?"
"Nothing too valuable.
It should be high density, shouldn't break easily under impact, and should be easily workable.
I see, you want to engrave it.
He nodded.
You could say that. It would be great if I could use a lathe.
Then an iron meteorite, the collector said as he opened a glass case and took out a dark-coloured stone the size of a walnut.
This one.
It's composed mainly of iron and nickel, with cobalt, phosphorus, silicon, sulphur and copper.
You want dense? This one's 8 grams to the cubic centimetre.
It's easily workable and highly metallic, so the lathe won't be a problem.
Good. It's just a little too small.
The collector took out another piece the size of an apple.
Do you have anything even bigger?
The collector looked at him and said,
This stuff's not sold by weight. The big ones are expensive.
Well, do you have 3 the size of this one?
The collector brought out 3 iron meteorites of roughly the same size and began to lay the groundwork for his asking price.
Iron meteorites are not very common. They represent just 5% of all meteorites, and these 3 are fine specimens.
See here? This one's an octahedrite.
Look at the crisscross pattern on the surface.
They're called Widmann-Statten patterns.
And here's a nickel-rich ataxite.
These parallel lines are called Neumann lines.
This piece contains camasite, and this one is taenite, a mineral not found on Earth.
This piece is one I found in the desert using a metal detector, and it was like fishing a needle out of the ocean.
The car got stuck in the sand, and the drive shaft snapped. I almost died.
Name your price.
On the international market, a specimen of this size and grade would have a price of about $20 per gram. So how's this? 60,000 yuan per piece, or 180,000?
Zheng Beihai took out his phone.
Tell me your account number. I'll pay right away.
The collector said nothing for quite some time. When Zheng Beihai looked up, he gave a slightly embarrassed laugh.
Actually, I was ready for you to counter-offer.
No, I accept.
Look, now that space travel is for everyone, the market price has dropped somewhat, even though it's not as easy to get meteorites in space as it is on the ground. These, well, they're worth...
Zheng Beihai cut him off decisively.
No, that's the price. Treat it as a sign of respect for their recipients.